Good day, everyone, and welcome to the oral argument in McCutcheon's versus FEC conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Nicholas Alexiou. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Alexiou. I am the Associate Director for Network Communications here at the American Constitution Society, and we're so glad you've all joined us for our call today on the oral argument that just concluded in McCutcheon versus FEC. We've got two great speakers here with us today. The first is Jessica Ring Emerson. She is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Jenner & Block, where she concentrates her practice in appellate and Supreme Court matters. She was also co-author of an amicus brief on behalf of the Democratic members of the House of Representatives in McCutcheon. She's a graduate of Georgetown University and Harvard Law School and a former clerk to Merrick Garland of the D.C. Circuit. Also with us today is Justin Levitt, an associate professor of law at Loyola Law School, Los Angeles, where he specializes in constitutional law and the law of democracy, with a particular focus on election administration and redistricting. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, Justin was a counsel at the Brennan Center at NYU for 5 years. He's also a former clerk to Stephen Reinhardt on the Ninth Circuit and a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School and the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. So we're going to start, Jessica, if you'd start by telling us a little bit about the case and what you saw today in oral argument, because you were actually in the Supreme Court today.
Sure. Thanks, Nick, and thanks to ACF for hosting this. So what is at stake in this case are what are called aggregate limits under the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. And the act actually sets forth two types of contribution limits, base limits, which are the amount of money that an individual can give to any candidate or political party, and then aggregate limits, which is a total cap on the total amount that any one person can give to a number of candidates and political parties. And so what was at stake today were the aggregate limits. However, many people wondered whether, in fact, the court would revisit the idea of throwing out the base limits as well as the aggregate limits. And this dates back to a 1976 case called Buckley v. Valeo, in which the court upheld contribution limits under a lesser standard of scrutiny than expenditure limits, as being as not violating any sort of First Amendment problems. And so people had wondered whether the court today was actually going to revisit what it had done in Buckley and hold contribution limits to the same First Amendment standard that it had held expenditures. So the courtroom today, I would say that the aggregate limits faced a somewhat skeptical court. You have three members of the court, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Kennedy, who have been have expressed a lot of concerns with contribution limits in the past and have indicated that they feel that they do not meet First Amendment scrutiny. So a lot of people were watching for the reactions from Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito today. And I think it's fair to say that both of them appeared skeptical of the aggregate limits, but not necessarily willing to throw out the entire framework of campaign finance and First Amendment jurisprudence applying to campaign finance. Chief Justice Roberts asked, was really asking whether there was a way to get at some of the concerns about corruption of the process by doing something other than imposing an aggregate limit. He described the aggregate limits as being kind of a blunt instrument to get at what the Congress was actually trying to achieve. And Justice Alito also asked he seemed to indicate some willingness to look at the different aggregate limits separately, so the limits on aggregate limits on contributions to candidates versus political parties. Justice Scalia was just hostile in general to contribution limits. Both he and Justice Kennedy asked sort of several times about whether if the real fear was corruption, what was the difference between feeling indebted to someone who could write a large check to a joint fundraising committee versus someone who would start their own PAC and spend a lot of money on independent expenditures. That Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor both indicated a few times that they thought this might be better suited for the court to decide the case on a more developed record. The case below was decided on a motion to dismiss with no real record, and so both of them seemed to think that there might be something to do for the lower courts below. And Justices Kagan and Ginsburg both asked probably their most some very skeptical questions of the attorneys for Mr. McCutcheon and the RNC. Justice Kagan posed some very interesting hypotheticals to counsel for McCutcheon and the RNC about the ways in which people could circumvent the base limits if the aggregate limits were taken away through the mechanism of joint fundraising committees. So it was a very spirited argument, and the advocates all did terrific job, and we'll just have to see what comes out now from the court.
Great. Thank you so much, Jessica. And Justin, if you can give us maybe more of an academic perspective and where this case sort of fits into the overall Roberts Court's jurisprudence on the issue of campaign finance.
Sure. And in doing so, I'll just highlight a few things that Jeff said. One, to make clear, because this can be a little bit confusing and some of the reporting has blended some of the issues involved. The easiest way to think about this case is there are individual, as Jeff said, base limits, $5,200 that you can give maximum to a candidate over 2 years. This case is about a total aggregate limit. So if you give $5,200 to one candidate and then another and then another, the law separately says that you can give a total of almost $50,000, but no more. And so this case is really about not whether it's okay for the government to limit the individual amount that you can give any one candidate, but whether if it says you can only give $5,000 to one candidate, why you can't give that same amount to not just 10 candidates, but 11, 12, 13, even 100. This is an issue that, as Jeff says, goes back to 1976 and the Buckley versus Valeo case. All campaign finance rules essentially go back to Buckley versus Valeo. But that opinion was almost 300 pages long, and it spent all of 6 sentences on aggregate limits. That is, there are a lot of justices who had an awful lot of thoughts about the campaign finance regime and spent an awful lot of time arguing about basic concepts, but really didn't spend much time on the question that's currently before the court. This case, in some ways, is a poor vehicle to revisit the 300 pages worth of Buckley, the basic distinction between contributions to a candidate and expenditures on speech outside of a gift to a candidate. Expenditures, money that you use to put out an ad or money that you give to someone else to pay for posters or billboards or what have you. And contributions, really, just giving a suitcase of money directly to either a party or a candidate or a committee that gives money to parties or candidates. The law since 1976 has had a pretty basic distinction between the two, much more skeptical about limits on using your own money for speech and allowing the government a little more leeway to regulate suitcases of money directly to candidates. That's the sort of basic distinction that Jess indicated the justices weren't particularly eager to revisit today. I I can understand why there was a lot of attention when this case came up, essentially Chicken Little running around saying the sky is falling on the campaign finance regime. This isn't a good vehicle to do that, and so it's not particularly surprising that they would take a slightly more narrower approach. Instead of basically revisiting Buckley, this case, I think, fits into a line of campaign finance cases where the court has allowed a little more leeway to government to regulate itself, essentially. These are political officials putting limits on how much money political officials can take in, how much money parties can take in as an aggregate level. And so the court has, in the past, seen less reason to protect parties, protect candidates from themselves, essentially. If Congress wanted to get rid of the limits, the aggregate limits on how much one individual can give to everybody involved in the system, they could tomorrow. The fact that they haven't done so shows that Congress is a little concerned about one person giving lots of money to everyone in the system. And thus far, the courts have paid attention to that concern. Which all means that this case essentially boils down to three different cases because there are three very different types of entities we're talking about here. One is an aggregate limit on how much individuals can give to political parties. One is an aggregate limit on how much people can give to candidates. And one is an aggregate limit on how much people can give to PACs, political committees, fictional entities that arise in the context of one or more elections. And I wouldn't be surprised, again, as Jess indicated today, if the justices come out with different answers on each of the three. Contribution limits receive more latitude, but they still have to satisfy an intermediate level of scrutiny. That means there's got to be a good reason to have a contribution limit. And there may be very different reasons, some of which may be better than others, why the government can justify a limit on giving in the aggregate to political parties, why the government can justify in the aggregate a limit on giving to candidates, and why the government can justify in the aggregate a limit on giving to PACs. And in some ways, this case is going to break down to exactly how pragmatic or realistic the court is willing to be. It takes a good amount of looking at real facts on the ground to understand how giving to all of the Democrats or giving to all of the Republicans is actually different from giving to 9 or 10 Democrats or giving to 20 Democrats. It takes a good amount of attention to the incentives of legislative leadership and getting contributions for all of their members. It takes a good amount of pragmatic attention to the possibilities that multiple PACs will arise and funnel money that they're given individually back to a single candidate at the end of the day. The court has varied, I think, quite a bit in how much attention it's willing to give real facts on the ground in election cases. And you see over the past 10 years, you see cases that sometimes pay enormous attention to on-the-ground facts and cases that sometimes seem completely oblivious to on-the-ground facts. And I think it's not immediately clear which route the court will take in this particular case. One other thing there that you can probably expect is that the chief has been very strategic in deciding who will write cases in the election realm and who he decides, assuming that he's on the majority voting side, whom he assigns to assign the case to will probably mean quite a bit, and will probably mean quite a bit not only for this case, but there will probably be language in there that indicates the path of the court on contribution limits to come. So I would watch not only the holding in this particular case, but who's writing for the court, and that certainly is something that we have no idea about today, but we'll get a much better view of the day the opinion comes down.
That's great, Justin. Thank you so much. For our listeners, if you have questions, you can just press *1 on your keypad, and that'll unmute you, and we'll be able to take your questions. But I'll get the ball rolling as you guys do that. a question for both of you. Sean McCutcheon, the petitioner in this case, had an op-ed in Politico yesterday in which he said that aggregate limits actually protect incumbents because incumbents are the first ones who are declared in a race and all donors just give out their max aggregate limit to incumbents, and it limits the pool of money that's available for challengers in congressional races. And that's why we see, or one of the reasons why we see, such high level of reelection rates in the House and the Senate. I was wondering if you guys, do you think that's true? And if so, is maybe that why Congress hasn't revisited these aggregate limits over the years?
I tend to be pretty skeptical of that explanation. There are some donors who would prefer to give to every single candidate, challenger or incumbent. But those donors, especially that have a lot of money at their disposal, also tend to be pretty strategic about how they give their donations. You don't see many donors who unthinkingly give multiple thousands of dollars up to hundreds of thousands of dollars to particular candidates without really sussing out whether there are potential challenges they might prefer, whether there are different candidates elsewhere in the country they might prefer to support. And sort of regular old folks who will contribute to their representative or somebody from their district don't run afoul of the aggregate limits, even if they gave to the incumbent and eight or nine different challengers. That's a theoretical possibility, but I'm pretty skeptical that you have unsophisticated multimillionaires who run out of money before they see, or run out of the ability to give money before they see who's in the race. And I'm pretty skeptical that you have sort of regular old participants in politics who ever hit the aggregate limits at all.
Right, and I would just add to that, there have actually been studies done. The Brennan Center did a study, I believe, which showed that in following a case called Randall v. Sorrell, in which this was also, there was a similar issue, and it showed actually that, in fact, in state races, the most competitive races were the ones where contribution limits were actually lowest. So it does not appear that it seems to be protecting incumbents in the way that people have feared.
That's great. And again, if any of our listeners have a question, you can just press *1 on your keypad to ask a question. If you do, we ask that you just identify yourself by name and by your outlet. We don't have any questions right now in our queue. So, you know, Jessica, you just mentioned Randall versus Sorrell, and it seems as usually with this court, the quote-unquote swing justice is always Justice Kennedy. But as we touched on earlier, Kennedy is one of the three justices, along with Scalia and Thomas, who seem to be relatively in favor of striking down all campaign contribution limits and maybe even, you know, striking down Buckley. And it seems as in this case, Chief Justice Roberts is more of the swing vote. And 7 years ago in Randall versus Sorrell, he signed on to Justice Breyer's opinion, which basically upheld the underpinnings of Buckley. And so is there a reason to think that 7 years later, Chief Justice Roberts is willing to throw out what he had said in Randall versus Sorrell and also throw out Buckley? Or are we looking for maybe another narrow decision that sort of erodes at some of the limits as opposed to getting rid of them entirely?
Right. I think that it would be very difficult to, 7 years later, kind of repudiate what he had said in Randall v. Sorrell, where really adhering to stare decisis and to the Buckley framework was a big part of that, the opinion that he signed on to. And certainly in being in the courtroom today, he gave no indication that he was really looking to revisit the entire framework of Buckley and the distinction between contributions and expenditures. He seemed, he said at one point to Solicitor General Don Verrilli, who argued the case on behalf of the Federal Election Commission, Chief Justice Roberts kind of said, okay, you know, I get you. I grant you your concern about this 3.5, these donors who are going to write $3.5 million. He kind of agreed with him that that was sort of a concern. He said, my concern is more the smaller donor who donates the max of $2,600 to nine candidates and wants to contribute to a tenth and can't. And so he seemed to be looking for, were there other ways that that Congress could get at the the problem of corruption without restricting someone who maybe wants to actually just give to a few more candidates, someone like the plaintiff in this case, Mr. McCutcheon. So he definitely seems to be wondering whether, and frankly, whether those are mechanisms for the court or Congress. He seemed to indicate that this was more kind of a, he granted that there was some institutional competence to Congress doing this rather than the court.
It's also, I think it's worth pointing out, piggybacking off of what Jess just said, that it may be the exceptional sort of just dabbling in politics donor who's giving $25,000 or $50,000 to members of Congress or candidates for Congress, probably in addition to giving money to individual parties and also to individual PACs. If you want to give to more than 10 members of Congress, there's absolutely no limit on your doing so if you give less money. So giving $200 or $300 to plenty of members of Congress, giving $20 to all members of Congress. This isn't a limit on the number of members of Congress you can give to. It's a limit. The limit in contention is a limit on how much money overall you can pour into the campaign finance system, at least at the federal level. And as I mentioned before, some of this breaks down to really when you're contributing to that many different individuals, you're starting to attract the attention of leadership who desperately need to get a lot of campaigns financed, and there might well be more of a tie between the influence you have, not on any individual tenth member of Congress, but on how readily leaders are to return your calls and even do, unfortunately, illegal favors in return for the money.
Excellent. That's a great answer. Again, if you, anyone has any questions, feel free to press star 1 on their phone to open up the line to ask a question. And we don't have any current questions, so another one from me. Rick Hazen was in Slate the other day, and he said that the outcome of this case is less important than the way it's decided. And by that, he meant that if the court decides to strike down aggregate limits, that's one thing. But if they decide to apply strict scrutiny to contribution limits, that's a whole different matter. It, you know, basically would then match, you know, sort of the bifurcated path we talked about earlier. There's campaign contribution laws are governed by one set of rules. Campaign spending laws are governed by a different set of rules. And Buckley has set forth strict scrutiny for campaign spending laws, but not campaign contribution laws. And so do we think that this might be a case where the court applies strict scrutiny to campaign contribution laws to match what we have on campaign spending laws, or will they keep that sort of bifurcated nature in place, thereby not overturning Buckley?
So Rick's absolutely right that the way this case is decided matters much more than the actual outcome. And it's also true that the bifurcation has become clear, but the language has not. So the court always talks about close scrutiny or exacting scrutiny or heightened scrutiny. And there's a lot of wiggle room in prior cases about exactly how close that means the court's going to look. It has come to pass, as you say, that the court has paid much more attention to limits on expenditures, on producing speech and using money to produce speech, and has stepped off the gas a little bit or let off the gas a little bit in terms of its scrutiny on contributions, giving money to someone. And I don't think, and I think Jess can say whether she heard anything to that note today, I don't think that the court will revisit that assumption, that it ought to be far more skeptical of limits on spending money to produce speech than it should on limits to giving money. Spending money to produce speech is in some ways a direct facilitation of speech. You can only produce speech that people can hear in the modern environment if you spend money to do it. You can shout in a park, but few people will hear you, and even buying a bullhorn is spending a little bit of money to make sure that your message is heard elsewhere. Giving money to people, on the other hand, is a very indirect proxy for speech. It may be that if I give candidate money that the candidate uses to promote his or her own message, it may be that the candidate buys chairs or desks, it may be that the candidate gives that money to somebody else whom I don't agree with at all. Once I fork over the cash, it's out of my hands and can be used on speech or used on something entirely different. And that may mean that it's a little less at the core of what we consider our First Amendment protections and is part of why the court has been more willing to allow more regulation of that sort of thing. There's reason for the court to maintain the distinction, and from what I heard from Justice Report earlier, there isn't much taste on the court, at least in oral argument, for completely revisiting the Buckley framework today.
Right. I agree with that. I did not see any indication that the court appeared to be ready to revisit the sort of differing levels of scrutiny between contribution limits and expenditures, and that was despite granting argument time to counsel for Senator McConnell, who, while the parties briefed mainly just the aggregate limit issue, Senator McConnell expressly urged the court to overrule Buckley and to subject contribution limits to strict scrutiny, and he did not seem to be getting much traction with that argument. I'll say one other thing that was in Rick's piece in Slate that was something I was certainly watching for in the argument today was whether the court would, whether there would be questions sort of about the definition of corruption and exactly what counted as corruption, because the Buckley court talked about corruption or the appearance of corruption, and in Citizens United, the court seemed to really narrow the definition of corruption to just really kind of quid pro quo, outright bribery almost. While there were several questions about corruption, they were more in the nature of trying to get the Solicitor General to justify why it would be more or less corrupting for an individual to give, say, $3.5 million circumventing the base limits by giving $3.5 million in the absence of aggregate limits versus going out and starting their own PAC and spending that $3.5 million through sort of an independent expenditure organization. And one of the moments of some levity in the argument came after several of these questions when Justice Kagan said, well, of course, if the court wants to revisit its conclusion that independent expenditures of that size and nature don't lead to corruption, we can, of course, do that. But the Solicitor General sort of took those questions took the framework as a given that the court has said that independent expenditures of a large nature are not corrupting. So that was, I think, another sort of interesting point that a lot of people were watching for in argument today, and it did not seem that the court was it will be interesting when the opinion comes out to see how the court actually defines corruption.
And just in line with what Jess just mentioned, it is true that Justice Kennedy, writing for the court in Citizens United, said that independent expenditures could not corrupt as a matter of law. But I think most observers of the court realize that is at best overwritten. In fact, Justice Kennedy, just the year before, in a decision called Caperton versus Massey Cole, recognized that someone spending multiple millions of dollars on independent ads in a judicial case could well get a result out of a judge. That is recognized quite directly that independent expenditures could either corrupt or appear to be corrupting. I think the difference between, and that's Justice Kennedy, the same author of Citizens United. One way that academics have reconciled those cases is to recognize that what the court was really doing is saying the chance that a large amount of money may actually sway a decision maker is something that we can and should recognize, but what we do about it will vary. And so that may not be sufficient reason to shut down speech that's independently produced. It may be a sufficient reason to force a judge to recuse him or herself. And it may be a sufficient reason, this is in part what we'll see out of McCutcheon, to limit the amount that someone can contribute directly to a candidate or a party or a PAC. That is, I think if you read the trend of opinions, what you realize is not a refusal to recognize that large amounts of money can possibly corrupt, but the fact that if we take that as true, what we do about it may depend on the context. And in that way, contributions present a very different context than independently producing speech.
Thank you both. And again, I'll, we're open for questions. I'll ask our moderator on the call to give the instructions for logging in to ask a question.
It's star one if you'd like to pose a question at this time. Again, that's star one to pose your question.
And while we wait for folks to press star one, Jessica, as I mentioned in my introduction, you and some of your colleagues at Jenner and Block wrote an amicus brief on behalf of certain members of the Democratic House of Representatives. And I was wondering if you could just give a bit of an overview as to what that amicus brief touched on.
Sure. So it was written on behalf of 85 members of the Democratic members of the House. And it really was focused on two issues. The first was kind of deference and institutional confidence, that Congress is an organization that is much better suited to determine what sorts of limits there should be on campaign spending, and then is a court, that Congress obviously has much more experience with campaigns and elections, and in addition, you know, has the resources to do the kind of research and hold hearings, et cetera, and pass legislation to try to determine what appropriate limits would be for campaign contributions. And so the court should continue to defer to the elected branches, and that the elected branches are really trying to be responsive to their constituents. So that was the second point of the brief, was that the danger of corruption remains real, and just as importantly, the appearance of corruption is something that the members of Congress care very much about. They want to ensure that their constituents continue to have faith in the system, especially in this day and age, in which many people appear to be losing faith in their elected leaders. And so to the extent that aggregate limits help to give people faith that their elected leaders are not for sale to the highest bidder, that is something that the Democratic members of the House who signed on to this brief care very much about.
Thank you so much, Jessica. Again, if anyone has any questions, please press star one. I guess maybe in summary, if we've kind of touched on how we think the case might turn out and whether or not it will be broad or narrow, but I guess maybe if both of you could just give your opinions on what you think the final verdict in this will be.
It's always dangerous to speculate, and I know there's always cause to do so. I think we'll only know the final version on the day the opinion comes out. That said, my own guess is that a majority of the court, however it's cobbled together, will recognize differences in what the plaintiffs are asking for. We'll recognize that the aggregate limits on contributions to parties may be different from the aggregate limits on contributions to candidates, may be different from aggregate limits on contributions to PACs. In some ways, the plaintiff's best case, that is the place where it's hardest to find the justification to limit aggregate limits, are in the restrictions on giving to parties. In some ways, the plaintiff's worst case, that is where it might be easiest for the government to limit aggregate limits and find good reason to do so, is on the aggregate limits to political committees, to fictional entities that can pop up and disappear whenever they wish. And so I might expect the court to treat the three different types of recipients at issue in this case differently, while making clear that they will treat aggregate limits, like any restriction on campaign finance, skeptically, but not quite as skeptically as they do with independent expenditures, with speaking directly.
Yeah, and I agree with that, Justin. The only thing I would add to that, adding also the same caveat that it's always very dangerous to speculate, but is that in so doing, the court may well realize that because they're dealing with three different aggregate limits, and they have no record as to how any of them actually work in practice or what any of them really mean in terms of how they would be circumvented, et cetera, there was at least some movement from the more liberal members of the court to actually have the case sent back for development of a record, and I wonder whether that is something that the court might actually entertain doing, postponing to another day the final verdict on the limits.
Thank you both so much for joining us today, and thank you for everyone who called in. I think it was a very fascinating and informative discussion, and we look forward to seeing how the court eventually rules on McCutcheon versus FEC. So thank you again to Justin and Jessica, and we look forward to talking to you all soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.